Our next topic this evening that we'll be discussing is Judaism and Modern Technology Resolving the Conflict. This is again in the spirit of continuing with broad items initially and then moving further into discussion over the weekend. For this topic, it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Eisenberg to the audience. Dr. Eisenberg is a radiologist. He works at the Albert Einstein Hospital in Philadelphia. He is well known in the area of medical ethics, Jewish medical ethics in particular. He is an assistant professor at Thomas Jefferson University. He is the director of Jewish Medical Ethics Initiative at Albert Einstein Hospital. He is a noted lecturer. He has been invited as a scholar in residence to multiple places around the country and I think beyond the country in terms of his expertise. He has many publications in the area of Jewish medical ethics, both in peer-reviewed articles, and he is an avid internet writer. You don't have to go further than looking at his website, and you will see that he is quite involved in the area of Jewish medical ethics. It gives me great pleasure and honor to introduce Dr. Eisenberg.
Thank you very much for inviting me. This is going to be a kind of more practical than philosophical talk. I'd like to direct you to the article which is in the handout, which I wrote for ASIA, the English Jewish Medical Ethics Journal put up by Schlesinger Institute. So if you want to read the real deep stuff, I would say look over there. This is more just to give you an idea of how we interact with technology, to bring up some examples, how it affects us, and less a deep analysis. Now, today, this is the kind of thing that I can understand. I never understood when I was little. I thought that's so silly that grown-ups have to have their kids program the VCRs for them. I now have to ask my kids how to use my computer, and I'm pretty computer literate. So this is the father saying, the reason I have no interactive device, like a clicker or a beeper, is because I'm reading a book. Now that may seem obvious to you, but it shouldn't be so obvious, because there's a question of how much longer we're going to be able to read books. This is Newsweek magazine from not so long ago, Books Aren't Dead, and this is a headline from CNN from a few months ago. Amazon.com is selling more e-books than printed books. Tonight we're going to discuss the idea that technology is affecting every aspect of our lives, personal, religious, as Jews, and it's affecting Judaism. It affects when we keep Shabbos, it affects the way we daven, it affects all the areas of our life. This is the Atlantic Monthly from December. People of the e-book, observing Jews struggle with Shabbos in a digital age. And I found this amazing, right? The migration of print media on the web and digital devices has stirred society to ponder big questions. Is Google making us stupid? Has technology short-circuited our children's attention spans? Are we frittering away our lives beneath smartphone screens? All this while the most obvious question was unanswered. What will Jews read on Shabbos? This is a secular magazine, and it's really not such a joke. Even the most obvious Shabbos comfort, a city read a book, may disappear. Now, for years I had said the only thing that saves the Jewish publishing industry is going to be Shabbos. You wonder if that's actually going to happen. Art School has recently said they plan on putting out every one of their books as an e-book, except for their Shabbos Yom Kippur. Thank goodness. Right? I didn't see. I want to point out, but there's a lot of word slides. It's not that important. You can have copies afterwards if you want. They're there for me to remember what to say and for you to kind of get an idea. Okay. So technology affects us just like it affects everybody else. Before I get into how it affects Jews in particular, we should realize that we benefit in the same way that everybody else benefits. For instance, modern transportation has led to the following. It used to be that esrogim were fairly rare. The idea of getting an esrog in a city in Europe was a big deal. There wasn't a lot about what happens if there's only one esrog in the city. Now, how many of you here actually deal in real life with the idea of there being one esrog in your city? Today, you can get them anywhere, right? You can get them on the internet, forbidden.com, the esrog headquarters, go out at the street corner. Modern transportation has revolutionized the way we practice our religion. But this is not an example of technology affecting us in particular. It's just one of the benefits we get, just like everybody else. On the other hand, we suffer the same as everybody else. I want you to turn off your cell phone. So that's a generic. That's actually from some movie theater. But this is what you're going to start to see in your synagogue. Please turn off all cell phones before entering our synagogue. Right? For better reception, power down. Unless it's a good ward calling you, you shouldn't have your cell phone on during services. So technology has a downside also. Now, we kind of have a lucky relationship with the technology. I actually love this cartoon. Down with technology. For more information, check out my website at notech.com. We love the excitement of all the new gadgets that we can get, like this little thing in my hand so I can control that thing there. Makes life much, much easier. But I understand that technology has some downsides. It displaces workers. It alters society. Travel has made it possible for people to live anywhere, and so families are now broken up. You can have members of family living thousands of miles apart. Privacy is basically gone. I mean, as a physician, I have a beeper, I have a cell phone, I have a BlackBerry that my son is carrying. I was trying to explain to my kids a concept that they don't understand. The idea that there was a time when you went home from work and you were home, right? And that was it. That does not exist anymore. So there are upsides and there are downsides. And you have to remember that the downside is very real for some people. I mean, how many people should have EasyPass? I don't know if Canadians have EasyPass. But I love my EasyPass. But the toll taker who lost his job when EasyPass came out was not quite as thrilled with EasyPass as I am. Now, the fact that over time, technology tends to improve the economy. Over time, eventually, people get re-educated. They find new jobs. And there are more jobs. But in the short term, it's not so simple. And in fact, there is a long history of opposition to technology. Between 1811 and 1817, there was an anti-technology social movement that spread through England called the Luddites. They actually went around destroying machines. It was mostly textile firms. It was so bad in England that they outlawed this machine breaking. They made it a capital offense, and people were executed for breaking machines. This is a strange quote thing I found on Wikipedia, a new form of technology. That is, there was a point where there were more British troops fighting the Luddites in England than fighting Napoleon Bonaparte on the Iberian Peninsula. It was a real serious, serious thing. And while the movement had economic motivation, the term Luddite has come to mean anyone who opposes industrialization, technology, and technological advance. Now, you have to realize that technology is not a thing. It's a process. That is, while objects clearly arise from technology, technology is really just making, using, understanding ideas, tools, techniques. It's basically improving our quality of life by making better things. And while this quality improvement leads to abandoning prior mechanisms, right, for better ones, again, as I said, it's not always so happy for the people who get abandoned. So what I'd like to point out is, and now start discussing, is the kind of the Jewish approach to technology. I thought the title was very interesting for us to talk about, dealing with the conflict. It's not clear to me why there has to be a conflict between Judaism and technology. The only real conflict arises when new technology challenges the observance of Judaism or poses a philosophical challenge. Otherwise, as Dr. Steinberg said, it doesn't matter. Technology is not a new thing. We act as if technology got invented 1,000 years ago, 500 years ago. That's not the case. Torah says, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, and every living thing that moves on the earth. As Dr. Steinberg said, there, from the very beginning, Hashem said, it's our job to innovate. But I want to get a little more specific. What was the first technology described by the Mephoshim? Any idea? What? No. Fire. It says in Bereishis Rabba that on the first Motzi Shabbos of creation, as it got dark, Adam Rishon, Adam the first man, started to get nervous. So what did Hashem do? He prepared for two stones, and he, Adam, rubbed them together, and fire came forth, and he recited a blessing over the fire. What blessing did he recite? Well, Borei Mereha Esh, it's the bracha we make at Havdalah. Havdalah is actually a bracha we make on the first creation of technology. So what's the Jewish approach to this technology? So if you look in the Gemara Pesachim, it describes the same story, and says that basically Hashem inspired Adam with knowledge of a kind similar to divine knowledge. So what's our approach? The first technology is fire. It comes straight from Hashem being given to Adam. It's a gift from Hashem. It is a form of divine knowledge and divine wisdom that is given over to people. Now, because I also realize there's a downside to technology, right? If you think that the Industrial Revolution, that the explosion of technology recently is like was unexpected, you should know the Zohar says, in the 600th year of the 6000, which is what year? So I wrote this down so I would get this right. The year is 1840. So in 1840, the gates of wisdom on high and the wellsprings of lower wisdom will be opened. This will prepare the world to enter the 7,000, just as the man prepares himself towards sunset on Friday for the Sabbath. Now, what's interesting is to know that also there is a quote, and I want to make sure I get this right, from Sichta Rabbosai, right? The Rebbe Lazar teaches that in the Messianic Age, which we're all waiting for, it will begin in a generation with the ability to destroy itself. So there is a downside, and Chazal realized that while technology can be great, it can also be very, very dangerous. So let's start to discuss how we interact with technology. All right. So today we have an atomic clock. So if I asked you what time it is, you would know exactly. In fact, if you had an atomic clock, you'd know to the millisecond, nanosecond. But it wasn't always like that. In fact, the very first Masechta in the Talmud, in the first few pages, is going through a discussion of a very, but to us, the obvious question is, how do you know what time it is? Right. The Gemara wants to know, in fact, the first Mishnah wants to know, Brachos, when can we start saying Shabbat at night? And the answer is not, well, just look on your, you know, look on your iPad and see, figure out what time safety is, right? What time the stars come out. They have all kinds of signs and symbols. There are Mishmaros and Nelila, there are watches in the sky and the earth. Very complicated discussion. Gemara wants to know, how did David and Melech know what time to wake up? Does at midnight he'd wake up? Now, the first technology for time was a sundial. But each of these technologies I'm going to tell you about had some downsides, and some walk downsides too. What's the main problem with the sundial? What do you do at night? Well, it's cloudy is the problem. What do you do at night? So the Gemara wants to know, right, how does David and Melech know what time midnight is? Even more so, the Gemara over there wants to know, Moshe Rabbeinu. In the Torah it says that Hashem said to him that God is going to strike the firstborn, right, at midnight. And Moshe turns around and says that Hashem is going to strike the Egyptians around midnight. Moshe says, what, God doesn't know what time it is? He says, no, the Egyptians don't know what time it is. They're afraid that when Moshe, that of course Hashem is going to strike at midnight, but their clock's going to be wrong. Of course, they don't have any clocks. They're going to say, Moshe's a liar. So telling time was a big issue. So over time, we developed more and more things. Clocks work at night, but they're not portable. Watches allow time to be constantly monitored, but what if you forget to look? Right? What if there's no Eru? Now we have digital alarm clocks to remind us that it's time to perform mitzvah. But what about turning it off on Shabbos or touching the button? So serial improvements in timepieces have progressively improved our ability to know when the time has arrived and pass through various time down mitzvahs. But each has a drawback and is a limitation how far we can carry it. So you should realize that technology has made our lives more complicated in some ways peculiar to us, right? For instance, when I was little, it was very simple. You turn the oven on before Yontif, and it stays on. A lot of ovens don't work like that. For your own safety, the oven automatically turns itself off on Yontif. So now you have these automatic turn-offs. This was not created out of anti-Semitism. This was created to increase safety. But one of the unintended consequences of technology was making our lives more complicated. Or motion detectors. You walk out on a Friday night down the street, and everyone's got a motion detector to turn the lights on, and the issue comes up. What do you do? Now, I want to make it very clear. Any of the law issues I bring up, I recognize that other opinions, and any opinion that I give is just, not my opinion, is just brought up to tell you there is an opinion like that which fits in what we're discussing. I recognize there are, I haven't seen my rebbe from Yeshiva hold that that's not a problem at all. That's not the issue tonight. Okay. On the other hand, just generic technology has improved the quality of our lives in ways peculiar to us. How do you solve that problem, I said, with the alarm clock that once it goes off on Shabbos, what do you do? Well, now we have a kosher clock, right? What do you do with the cholent? Well, you have a slow cooker now. You get a crock pot. We solve the problem of the automatic turnoff of the oven with now the Shabbos mode ovens. Multiple, I don't know, it's well in Canada, but in America, multiple companies now make Shabbos mode ovens. It is a little bit of a controversy in itself about how you can use these and what's allowed. But nevertheless, this has improved our lives in a way that takes advantage of just the regular technology that's out there already. And of course, among the most important are Shabbos clocks and timers. Your lights can go on and off on Shabbos. But there are some forms of technology that have improved our ability to keep mitzvahs in particular. That is, having your lights go on and off on Shabbos may be able to learn more, you know, later. But that's not intrinsic. But Gassos Tefillin, for instance, right? This tefillin, which is, I would say, arguably the best kind of tefillin you can get, requires a hydraulic press to create. You can use really tough hide now. If you go to Yerushalayim, the place where I got my tefillin, right, the sofer has a little display of tefillin were run over by a Mack truck and were kosher. But the parshas were not destroyed. Right? And this cloth, this is an ad I got off the internet. These tefillin scrolls were written by a qualified expert sofer. They were then thoroughly checked by two expert scribes, and an additional check was performed by a computer. And today, probably most reputable sofrim check the Torah's tefillin with a computer. And there are cases of, you know, of Torahs. I saw one recently that have been checked like 12 times, and then the 13th time they looked at the computer and they found a missing word. So this has increased our ability to keep mitzvahs in some ways. Now, additionally, an intrinsic, what's the most important thing for us in a way is learning, right? Well, this in and of itself was great technology, which was the invention of the printing press, right? But we're all used to that by now, so you don't really think about books as new technology. But what came after that was, well, you take the shas and you put it on a CD, right? And now you can listen to it on the CD. I remember when I first got married and started doing Daf Yomi. You had to call up, well, actually, the first thing was you had to go to the library in Brooklyn and you had to take out the tapes, the cassette tapes, and then you bring them back. Then they had it on the telephone, but you could only do it on the hour. Then they had the thing on the telephone where you could call in any time. Then it came out on CD, right? Then it came out on DVD, right? And not just on DVD, but on DVD where it'll highlight the words as the Maggid Shir gives the class, and you can hyperlink to any of the other sources, right? And now we have reached the ultimate technology, which is ShasPod. Carry your iPod everywhere you go. All of Shas. Now, this was in honor of Dr. Steinberg. Right? When I first got married, I wanted to buy Encyclopedia Talmudis. It's too expensive. What happens today? You buy Bar One CD, and incidentally, they throw in the entire Encyclopedia Talmudis. It costs less money than the cost of buying the Encyclopedia. That's a small advertisement. Buy the Encyclopedia. Right? It's a wild thing. No matter where you are, right? Just log on to the internet, and this is, for instance, eDaf. Any do Daf Yomi now from any computer, you can get the Daf. Hebrewbooks.org has now put onto the internet thousands and thousands of obscure out of print Svarim. All right, so you knew all that. That's not so exciting. What I want to now move on to a little bit is the idea of technology that's being created exclusively for Jews. This is an article from the New York Times from 2008. The rabbis, scientists, and engineers at the Soma Institute are trying to solve the problems that arise when technology and the Torah collide. Working from the research facility in the West Bank settlement of Alon Shvut, they create electronic devices from phones to alarm systems to motorized vehicles that obey Orthodox Jewish laws about the Sabbath. And even turning on electric current or off is forbidden. Now, last summer I was in Israel. I went with my son to Tzomet. It is a wild place. The technology I told you about so far was just us taking advantage of pre-existing technology that everybody else uses. Everyone's got an iPod, so we stick shots on the iPod. Right? Everyone's got a CD player, so we stick. Tzomet Institute is an organization that exists to create technology to solve halakhic problems, just for us. And they have multiple publications. Go to their website. It's a really, really fascinating thing. These are examples of all the technologies they've created that are usable, things you would think you would not be able to use. Here's an example. This is the story I heard when I was at Tzomet. Hello, this is Shlomo Zalman. That's for Shlomo Zalman Arba. When Rabbi Yisrael Rose, the dean of the Soviet Institute, first heard this on the phone, he didn't realize it was on the line, but after the speaker repeated his name, Rabbi Rosen recognized the voice of the well-known Torah scholar, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Arbach, who has unfortunately passed away since then. Rabbi Arbach, one of the leading halakhic authorities in the previous generation, was an expert on the halakha of electricity technology. Rabbi Arbach invited Rabbi Rosen to join him on a visit to the handicapped woman who regularly used a wheelchair. In fact, it was not so urgent since her family was able to move her around, but because of her strong desire to be independent, especially to be able to leave her home on Shabbos, she asked the rabbi to find a way for her to use her electronic wheelchair on Shabbos, and Rabbi Arbach was able to help her. Right? Tzomet has created an electric wheelchair that's usable on Shabbos that people disabled can actually be independent. This is one small example of the multiple things that they are doing. So this is technology that we are using to create just for halakhic purposes. Okay, so that's got an introduction, but this is the Jewish Medical Ethics Conference, right? So let's talk about the effects of technology on practical Jewish medical ethics issues, right? Now, I'm a radiologist, and I read this, and this disturbed me. Determination of gender during ultrasound scans has been officially banned for years, but the practice continues. One 1999 report on the International Planned Parenthood Federation website says that between 500,000 and 750,000 unborn Chinese girls are aborted every year after sex screening. That was 2001, 2004. prenatal sex selection. The abortion of female fetuses was aided by the spread of cheap and portable ultrasound scanners in the 1980s. Illegal mobile scanning can provide a sex scan for as little as $50, according to the report. Quote, prenatal sex selection is probably the primary cause, if not the sole cause, for the continuous rise in the sex ratio at birth, said population expert Professor Chu Chen-Hun. Today in China, I believe, there's a 60 million man-woman disparity. They believe that 60 million girls were aborted due to ultrasound. And there is now, in 2004, there was a 1.2 to 1.0 ratio of boys to girls. So if you think we have a shidduch crisis, you've got to imagine what it's like in China. That is not a joke. 120 boys to 100 girls is not a small disparity. So the question now is this technology bad? Right? Moshe Feinstein, in Igros Moshe, wrote about something which I would say is similar, but used as an example, about amniocentesis. He said, I've said to Torah observant physicians that they should not perform amniocentesis because there is no practical purpose, since they're forbidden to abort the fetus, that will only cause suffering to the parents. Additionally, it will happen that they will go to a non-Jewish or non-Torah observant physician to have the pregnancy terminated, and the Torah observant physician will have transgressed the biblical injunction. Before a blind person should not place a stumbling block. Now, I think you could replace the word amniocentesis with the word ultrasound. Right? Look at what's happening in China. Right? This is bad stuff. Right? So before I go to the next one, I'll ask you, so what do we do? So is ultrasound bad? So I'm going to give you a case. Think about this for a minute. The wife of a Kohen is pregnant. If the baby is a boy, he must be protected from tumas mace. Tumas mace means that a Kohen, male Kohen cannot be exposed to a dead body. Can the pregnant wife of a Kohen go into the hospital to have her baby? Because maybe it's a boy. Some people say yes. We're voting. Some people say no. Maybe it's a boy. Nobody is the problem? Well, I did not come up with this problem, right? So the halakha forbidding Kohen from becoming tamei through contact with a dead body applies only to males and even to babies. If you think, well, it doesn't count, it's a bit. No, it applies to babies, that's in Shulchan Aruch. This creates an obligation on the parents to protect their child from becoming tamei meis. So you go back to the Middle Ages, time of the Renaissance, right? Look at the Rem writes. Well, it's allowed because of something called Seigsvägen. There's two doubts. Perhaps the baby is a girl. And if the baby is a boy, maybe it's a natal. Maybe it'll be stillborn. Therefore, the mother could enter a room with a corpse if she is in labor. Everybody happy with this? Why? Oh, getting there. Now, then, now, 18th century, now the process is, wait, that doesn't work. When the baby's head appears, he immediately becomes tamei. At this point, the possibility of a stillbirth really no longer applies. Therefore, the mother can't enter. And now you go to the 20th century. What's the reality? We don't do armchair philosophy. In real life, I can definitively, I'm a radiologist, I'm telling you, I can definitively determine the sex of the baby by ultrasound. And the incidence of stillborns is very low. Is there really a straight figure when one doubt can easily be clarified and the other is very uncommon? Right? So this is an example of new questions, right, that are thrust upon us by modern technology. A question that really we didn't have before. Now I can tell. Does the pregnant Cohen's wife have to find out the sex of the baby? She can know. So this is very interesting. Now, unfortunately, I could not get the little movie to work. For those of you who think that that's what an ultrasound looks like, you should know that today, that is what an ultrasound looks like. And I have to tell you the truth. The original picture I put in was far more graphic, because I can prove to you there is no question that you would tell the sex of the baby, but I decided no one would be in the audience, and so we will leave it at this and just say that yes, you would tell the sex of the baby. Right, and this was a little video which I can't get to play right now, which shows the baby opening and closing its mouth and sucking its thumb and its heart beating. You know, and by the way, the reason I put this picture up is this: you can see here the head, the body, the feet. That baby is 3 centimeters. See how big that is? It's this big, right? This is very, very, very early. Sort of Yosef Shlomo Elyashiv ruled that it's appropriate for a pregnant wife of a Kohen to have an ultrasound to determine the sex of the baby close to delivery date. And if it's a boy, you have the baby in the hospital, it's not problematic for Kohen. You either go to a woman's birthing center, or there are certain hospitals, particularly in Israel, that are careful about tumah. And that, yes, the modern technology has changed the halakha due to the new question. So as Dr. Steinberg said before, science and technology are morally neutral. The use of technology has moral implications. Let me give an example of something where technology has changed the final psak. I'm talking about 8-month babies. Now this, if you've heard this before, you won't be surprised. If you've never heard this before, I think it's going to blow your mind. Right? Gemara Shabbos, the rabbi said, one born after 7 months, we violate Shabbos for him. And at 8 months, we do not violate Shabbos for him. If there's a doubt as to whether it is a 7-month or 8-month baby, we do not violate Shabbos for him. At 8 months, he's like a stone. It's forbidden to move him on Shabbos. But his mother bends over and nurses him because of the danger to the mother. A baby that's born, right, at 8 months is considered to be non-viable, period. Can't move it. It's muktzah. It's like a stone, right? It is written in the Braisa, who is 8 months, whoever has not completed his months of gestation. Rebbe says his signs are testimony to his underdeveloped state, his hair and his nails, which are unfinished. But when they're fully developed, then we say it's a 7-month fetus whose birth was delayed. There's two flavors of babies, 7-month babies and 9-month babies. Anybody know who the first 7-month baby was? Moshe, right? One of the questions explained, why is it that Yocheved was able to keep Moshe at home for a little while, for let's say 3 months? Because he was a 7-month baby and they were waiting for 9 months. When that time came, she said, the Egyptians are waiting for another baby, and she put him in the forest. Okay, so what's the actual practical halacha? This is in the Shulchan Aruch. You go and open Aruch Chaim, you will see, one may do all that is necessary for a newborn child in Shabbos. This applies only if the child was born in the 9th or 7th month. But if a child was born in the 8th month, or it is doubtful as to whether he was born in the 7th or in the 8th month, one may not desecrate the Shabbos for him unless he has fully developed hair and nails. What do you think of that? A baby born 8 months. Now, some of you are physicians. What do you think of that? 8-month baby as long as he can't break Shabbos for him. Everyone in this room who's okay with that, raise your hand. Nobody? It was called an observing group. Okay. Now, here's the question. Is a baby born at 8 months really not viable? How does modern halakha deal with this apparent inaccuracy? There's two major ways you can approach this. There's this idea called Mishtana Teva. It's very simple. It just isn't like it used to be. Right? The Chazanish write some area of the opinion that an infant born before 9 months is not viable, and they despair of saving him and are not quick to attend to his medical needs. This is a mistake. We're obligated to exert ourselves for his medical needs and violate Shabbos for his medical needs. Many instances today affirm that infants born 8 months survive. You say, okay, that makes sense. Why? In earlier times, there was a minority whose development was completed at 7 months. The majority was completed at 9 months, but none were completed at 8 months. And for this reason, the sages said that it was a 7-month fetus whose birth was delayed. It appears that now nature has changed, and the medical opinion is that these 8-month fetuses continue their development after the 7th month and finished at 8. So the Chazanish's answer is, times have changed. That kind of baby basically doesn't exist anymore. We have a lot of examples like that. If you find it hard to eat the amount of matzah you're supposed to eat at Pesach, thank the Noda Yehuda for possibly having the biggest thumbs in, like, in the history of the world, right? He measured by thumbs, he measured volumes, he measured linear, and said, must be that the size of eggs have changed. So that's one answer. But then there's another answer. This is the Shevet Levi, who is alive today, living in B'nai B'rach, and says, we rely on what our own eyes see. Is it possible, even permitted, to ignore this truth? But thousands of such children have already emerged from incubators, and they are with us, alive and growing up. This is not the gate, the ruling of the Talmud and Halachic authorities, that it is forbidden even to move him. Because it is certain that in their days there was no hope of the child surviving. He was destined from the start to perish, and there was therefore like a stone. This is not so today when the prospects are good and it is common to sustain the life of such a child. Also, according to the foundations, the Talmud is permissible and obligatory to care for him and permissible to move him on Shabbos. Shevet Levi, right, is a rather Haredi rabbi. This is not an obscure, this is not a liberal opinion, this is a major postdoc who says, it's very simple. Modern technology has changed the halacha. It doesn't in any way undermine what the Gemara says. It simply is, now we have incubators. This is of Adi Yosef. In our times, an incubator has been introduced, and it is a daily occurrence. The infants are placed there, even those definitively born at 8 months, nonetheless survive and sustain life, and they bear children and grandchildren, certainly Shabbos should be violated for them. The bottom line is, modern technology has changed the halacha. It doesn't mean that we play games with halacha. It just means simply that we deal with the reality of halacha. And the reality of halacha today is 8-month babies will survive, and therefore, we clearly save them. Let's catch up to her. Right? Rav Arbach, even in a place where there is no incubator, we must consider the possibility that he could be a 7-month fetus whose birth was delayed. On the other hand, even in a fetus which is less than 7 months, when the claim of delayed was not applicable, we still violate Shabbos where there is an incubator because our eyes have seen that by means of an incubator they can live. Okay, so the consensus clearly is, you can all like let out your breath, we clearly save not just 8-month babies, but the age of viability today is something like 24 weeks. I'm not a neonatologist, but it's very, very far back. And we deal with whatever realistically is salvageable. And then technology creates completely new halakhic questions, ones that really didn't deal with before. The ones we just talked about are really thick questions that existed before. It's just technology has changed a little bit, right? So here is Star Wars: Attack of the Clones, and This is just a simple explanation of the way cloning works. In cloning, the full complement of DNA of an individual is placed in a denucleated egg cell, potentially involving three individuals in the process. There's a DNA donor, the denucleated egg donor, and the woman in whose uterus the fetus will gestate. But what the process does not include is the usual process of the joining of the egg and sperm of a potential mother and father. So one thing that's missing is, well, the conventional sense, would be asked, who's the father or the mother of a cloned woman? And that, I would say, is a pretty new question, which the government does not ask, who is the mother and father of a cloned woman? A clonal child wouldn't have a genetic mother or father. It would have a single nuclear donor. If a man cloned himself, the child would be neither that man's son or his twin brother, but it would be a new category of biological relationship, which would be called his clone. In a halachic sense, a clonal child might have one mother, the DNA donor at the birth, or the birth mother, two mothers, the DNA donor and the birth mother, no mother, no father, or one or two mothers who is or are also the father. Now, obviously, this is not the time to go into explanation of why, what all the opinions are, but this is an example where technology has raised questions which kind of baffle the mind. It would be very hard to find precedents for things like that, although there are. And if you think that cloning people, that's on the horizon, we don't do it yet, I'd like to introduce you to horse and the elephant. Right? 71 years ago, Dr. Seuss posed what would become, to me, a prophetic question. Who is the mother in surrogacy? Right? Horton hatches the egg. Right? And this is the story. 71 years ago, this is the date, this is Maisie, and she's sitting on an egg and she wants to go on vacation, and Horton the elephant comes along. She says, "Will you take a few minutes and sit on my egg?" So here's the surrogate. Right? So there's the genetic mother, and Horton is the surrogate mother. And then when the baby is about to be born, a confrontation between the genetic mother and the surrogate ensues. That's the bird yelling at Horton saying, "Give me back my egg, it's mine." Right? Then the baby hatches, and it is an elephant bird. And the people came shouting, "What's all this about?" They looked and they stared with their eyes popping out. Then they cheered and they cheered and they cheered more and more. They'd never seen anything like this before. "My goodness, my gracious." They shouted, "My word, it's something brand new. It's an elephant bird. And it should be like that." Well, maybe it should be like that, but unfortunately in real life, it's not like that, right? You don't wind up with some kind of combination between the genetic mother and the surrogate mother. And we need to answer the question, so who's the mother? So I wanted to throw out like four scenarios of surrogacy just to think about the idea of how complex these issues become with modern technology, right? And a woman provides the ovum and her uterus. Who carry the fetus to term for a mother woman who's infertile. The infertile woman's husband provides the sperm. The result is a child conceived through artificial insemination and implanted in the surrogate. Who's the mother? What? The surrogate. Well, this one's easy. The surrogate mother is the genetic mother as well as the person whom the ovulation, conception, pregnancy, and birth occur. That one's easy, right? There really is no contribution from this man's wife. Okay, how about this? Ovary donation. Donation of an ovary to a woman whose ovaries are not functioning. A child conceived is genetically related to the donor, but is the product of ovulation, conception, pregnancy, and birth from the surrogate mother. Now again, I'm not claiming to be an expert. I'm giving you, these are an example of a psak, and I, as Dr. Seiberg, there's always somebody I'm sure will disagree. Who's a mother? What do you think? There was a genetic donor, raise your hand. Everyone who says it's the recipient of the transplant, raise your hand. And everybody else doesn't want to vote. I think this was probably pretty straightforward also. I did not, just myself, this is Rabbi Bleich's opinion. The gestating woman is clearly the mother as the ovary became part of the recipient. I'm sorry, this is Rabbi Michael Broy from Atlanta. He came with this case. Okay, now, all right, I'm not going to answer these. I'm just going to throw these out. A single egg is removed from the genetic mother and fertilized in a petri dish or in a surrogate. The blastocyst is implanted in the surrogate mother. This is a more common case. Although ovulation occurs in the genetic mother, the gestation, the birth occur in the surrogate. Is maternity dependent on conception, gestation, or parturition? Is it the bottom line, just where this egg is conceived? Is it who's carrying the baby, or is it who gives birth to the baby? Right? How about fetal transplant? Fertilization occurs in the genetic mother. Okay, so the normal scenario. The fetus is then transferred into the surrogate mother's uterus. The surrogate mother carries the child to term. Fertilization, early gestation, occurred in one woman, and the rest of the gestation for fertilization occurred in another woman. Who's the mother? So these get harder and harder, as you can imagine. There, by the way, I'm going to talk about it in a minute, there is actually an example of this in Targum Yonasan, which is questionable about the accuracy of the actual text. It's questionable that you can learn from Haggadah, but it's a fascinating case anyway. So who's the mother in surrogacy? As we can see, fertilization, gestation, and parturition can be combined in multiple ways to create scenarios never before possible. Right? So who is the mother? The egg donor, the genetic mother, the birth mother, both mothers, no mother. So these issues are much too complicated to resolve tonight, but consider the following. Maybe there's no parents. Rabbi Eliezer, Rehuda of Oldenburg, Tzitz Eliezer, considers a child created by in vitro fertilization to have no father or mother. There is some support for the argument that there may be two mothers based on analogies to Orla, Omer, and grafting, which we can talk about at another time, but there are examples there of where you start the process in one phase, finish in another phase, and both phases are considered to be important, right? The idea that genetics and parturition are the factor, I think I got it wrong, gestation is the issue, is usually not considered to be the deciding factor. This is usually considered to be the deciding factor, birth. Twins born to a woman who can birth after conception, but before birth, are Jewish but not necessarily brothers. So we follow this now, right? You have twins. The mother's not Jewish when she conceives. She then converts while she's pregnant. She has two boys, right? The boys are Jewish, but they're not necessarily brothers. Just have to understand the idea that when someone converts, they cut off all genetic ties to everybody and have no relatives. This is too complex to go into tonight, but just take that my word for it. The Targum Yosef ben Uziel says that Dina was originally the womb of Rachel, and Yosef was the womb of Leah, and that Hashem did a fetus transplant after conception, and Torah clearly says that Yosef is Rachel's son, and that Dina is Leah's daughter, and therefore it would seem that it's the birth mother. Megillah Esther says that Esther had no mother because she died in childbirth. That childbirth is the deciding factor. So it would seem that parturition has the most support for determining maternity, right? So it's settled, since most opinions would favor the birth mother as the mother, right? Of course not. This is an article, January 25th, 2010. I take no responsibility, I'm just showing it to you. Many of the country's most influential rabbinical arbiters have gradually changed their minds from considering the woman who undergoes in vitro fertilization with donor eggs, the baby's halachic mother, to regarding the donor, even if she is not Jewish, as the real mother. This about-face rabbinical opinion from 2 decades ago has developed recently, but has not been made public before. The new opinion, according to Rabbi Dr. Mordechai Alpert, who's the head of the Schlesinger Institute, right, means that the government bills regulates the donation of ova must be passed immediately, even though it is not perfect. So even when you think you have it figured out, this is extraordinarily complex stuff. Technology brings up really wild ideas. Technology challenges our worldview. I thought I'd bring up one fast example: anesthesia for childbirth. Right, and that's why I got to read you an interesting quote. Right, so in the mid 19th century, anesthesia was developed. This is the Etherdome in Boston. Now, pain during surgery was not a big deal, but pain during childbirth, that was a big deal. And Rabbi Jacobowitz, former chief rabbi of Great Britain and considered the father of Jewish medical ethics, has a little section about anesthesia and childbirth. And he says that the notorious fight of churchmen in the last century against alleviation of the woman's birth pangs neither started with the application of chloroform by Sir James Young Simpson nor ended with the acceptance of the new drug by Queen Victoria at the birth of Prince Leopold in 1853. Some sects of Christianity took extreme affront to the concept of anesthesia in childbirth. Right? In fact, the report of the Joint Commission on Christian Healing informs us, quote, "Before the discovery of anesthesia, a woman in France was detected in an attempt to ease the pain of childbirth with the help of another woman. This was construed as a blasphemous attempt to thwart the curse that God had laid on Eve, and both women were burnt to death." This is not a Jewish source. This was a Christian sect, but understand, this was a big deal. The Torah says that after Eve's sin, there will be pain in childbirth, right? At the end of the last century, a Catholic medical moralist still forbade the use of chloroform at normal births. I significantly let our women be trained to have courage and resilience and to the proper appreciation of their high vocation and duties. And I guarantee they will not cry out for chloroform under the pangs of labor, but cling with redoubled love and sacrifice to the beings whom they bring into existence in pain. It was not, in fact, till 1948, right, that the Pope announced that you could have painless childbirth. So the concept of there being a philosophical objection was very real. Luckily, I'd like to tell you that
Rabbi Jacobowitz writes, in rabbinic writings, the question is never raised. As has been remarked, the prohibition of analgesis would contradict Jewish ideology. Indeed, the sympathy of Jewish law for the sufferings accompanying childbirth is so strong that some of its leading exponents justify the recourse to contraceptive sterilization by mothers who fear the pain of further births. We do not object to new technology. We figure out what it means. We have a heliocentric view of the universe, of the solar system. Somehow, even though it says that Yeshua, the time of Yeshua, the sun stood still, nevertheless, we accept the idea, I think so, of Copernicus, Galileo, that the earth goes around the sun. We accept it as technology comes up, right? It challenges our worldview. We deal with it, and we resolve it. We don't throw out the science. I had another little section to talk about, but I think we are running reasonably late, and so I think I will stop here. Any questions? So the parentless embryo. So with the given that I'm not a rabbi and not a post-sake, it would seem to me, right, although probably Dr. Steinberg would be able to answer this much better. Yeah, the question would be, if it were to be the case that a baby born by IVF has no mother or father, right, if there is no relationship, then it would seem to me, I guess, again, you'd have to ask your, as they say, your uncle in the tribe. It seems to me that they would be able to marry. In fact, like I said, if there is a woman, right, for instance, who is not Jewish and has twin boys, and after she has the babies, they convert, right? Make it simpler. The twins are a boy and a girl. They can marry each other. They are not related. So you'd have to ask, but it would seem less than me. It's not clear that the baby is Jewish. Is that the question was put to Eliezer, if there is no mother and father, why is the baby Jewish? I said it's not clear that the baby is Jewish. You know, you ask a very interesting question, because I give a weekly share on Hilchos Refuah, on Jewish medical ethics, and one week I decided to talk about, to look into the question of blood tests and DNA for identification. This is my observation. It's very interesting the way halacha works. At times, it is very clear what we want the outcome to be. And I don't mean by that to say that we play games with halacha. I mean to say the following, right? For example, we'll do anything to avoid a mamzer, right? And therefore, right, I'm not sure, there may be one exception, but in general, I don't think there's any Beis Din that will declare each other moms are based on a DNA test for a paternity, even though I saw a number that says there can be a 1 in 10 billion chance of being wrong. Right? So the answer to your question is kind of difficult. That is, there are times we simply say, if that's what Chazal said, that's the way we do it. There are Hilchos questions. They're much more straightforward. You don't have to have the complicated case you said, right? That a woman is not going to be pregnant until it's recognizable, which is in 3 months. And you could easily prove that a woman is pregnant much earlier than that. So again, that's another question for your local Orthodox rabbi. Okay.